Welcome to Flourish or Fold, Stories of Resilience. I'm Dr. Taryn Marie. And on this series, we have the opportunity to hear from well-known people who tell their often surprising, lesser well-known stories of resilience. Today on Flourish or Fold, Stories of Resilience, well-known people telling their lesser well-known stories of resilience, we have a guest, the man, the myth, the legend, an FBI agent who was one of a team of people who actually found the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, in a cabin in Montana. This is a very special guest for us because this guest is Greg Stascoll, former FBI agent who made his career in Michigan. And of course, it's no coincidence that we share a last name. Greg Stascoll is also my father. So join my dad and I as we talk about his career in the FBI, and specifically, whether or not we know who killed Jimmy Hoffa. Welcome back to Flourish or Fold, Stories of Resilience. We are speaking with well-known people and having conversations about their lesser well-known stories of resilience. Today, I have the opportunity to interview Greg Stascoll, formerly an FBI agent in the state of Michigan for over 30 years. And the fact that we have the same last name is not a coincidence. He's my dad. Dad, how's it going today?
It's going well, thank you.
We're so excited to have you here for this interview and to get to discuss resilience through your eyes, having a daughter who's an expert in resilience and also having been an FBI agent for 3 decades. Getting to discuss these concepts of resilience with you as you think about it through your lens is going to be really, really interesting.
I'm looking forward to I don't know that I've been interviewed by my daughter before, but I'm looking forward to talking with you.
I don't think I've interviewed you before either, so it'll be a new experience for both of us. If we just jump right in to really sort of the crux of what this show is about, it's about this idea of getting to tell stories of our challenges that are sort of behind the scenes or may not be well known. So as you think about a challenge or challenges that you faced in your past that have most shaped your life today, what would you say that is or those are?
And I think that obviously there are multiple answers for that because we all face challenges growing up, some more, I think, traumatic for people than others. But I think part of my early challenges, especially early in school, I wasn't, and I'm not exactly sure why, I had some difficulty in school for the first couple years, and I think I was probably somewhat socially awkward. I think part of it was because I was always the biggest kid in the class when I was growing up. But as time went on, I became more self-assured. And I think part of that was participation in athletics helped. And then my size obviously became an advantage. And academically, I don't know whether I was just slow developing as a student, but ultimately I had success in the classroom as well. So I think all of those things, and all of them sort of tempered by core values that were instilled in my youth by my parents and my involvement in scouts and church and things like that.
You know, it's fascinating because we're in our first series of Flourish or Fold, and I don't know that this will be something that everyone that we interview subsequently will say, but everyone that we have interviewed up until this point has literally said in some form or fashion, and you just said it again, that what they thought were their weaknesses, in your case, you know, being sort of the biggest kid in the class and, you know, maybe sort of socially awkward or like uncoordinated when you were younger, but what they thought were their greatest weakness or opportunity or drawback becomes their greatest advantage.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And in my case, I think it, all of those things sort of caused me to develop a strong work ethic. I felt like sometimes I had to work harder at things than other people did. But, and I'm sure you probably only think about the people that are successful at certain levels of your life and not necessarily the people that aren't as successful as you are. And you sort of fixate on that success. But at any rate, I think I did develop a pretty good work ethic, which hopefully I passed on to you.
Yeah, I think it's so good that I've received feedback for a number of years now that people wish I would tone down my work ethic. folks would wish I would work less. So I might be overusing your strength there.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. You have a new book out, FBI Case Files. Talk to us about the book that you wrote. And have you now seen some of those case files in a different light, looking back on them in retrospect?
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, I think you do. First of all, the book itself is nothing more than a compilation of stories of cases I was involved in. I emphasize in the book that it's not a autobiography. It's not a memoir. It's not about me. It's a compilation of stories, and I'm the storyteller. And in some of those cases, I was involved more so than in others. As I say, all cases have stories attached to them, some more than others. And I just picked ones that I felt were, well, they had some notoriety at the time. Cases like the Unabomber, or the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, things like that. And some lesser known, but I felt good stories that depict the good work that was done by my fellow agents in the FBI, but also by local and state law enforcement and people that cooperated with us along the line. So in answer to the second part of your question, they definitely, it's funny, and looking back on them, it's for lack of a better word, sort of therapeutic, because you do look at them and your perspective changes when you look back at something after it's been accomplished and after you see what you did. And I do feel I did all along that it was a very rewarding career. But when I look back on it now, I feel like it was something that I had always wanted to do since my youth. And I really felt like I had done it well. Had no regrets.
You know, many people don't realize that I think it's leftover or a holdover from the Hoover administration that the FBI still requires a mandatory retirement at 57, which obviously is much earlier than many people typically retired. Did you feel like that retirement came at a good time for you or a right time? And if you had stayed in the Bureau, been able to stay in the Bureau, what would you have done next?
The retirement age came about actually after Hoover had died. And it's across the board in federal law enforcement that you have to retire at 57 statutorily. I did get a 6-month extension. I actually stayed 6 months beyond. So I retired at 57 and a half. And they do still, under certain circumstances, give extensions. And I would have stayed longer if I could have. I stayed as long as I possibly could. Like I said, I had always wanted to be an FBI agent since almost as far back as I can remember. And I felt like this is what I always wanted to do, and I'm going to do it as long as I can. And I did. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it up until the day I retired. So had I stayed, I doubt that I would have stayed to my present age, but I certainly would have stayed a few years longer. I felt like I was really at the top of my game. The statutory retirement, I'm not exactly sure if there's a good reason for it other than it's sort of, they look at it as being sort of a paramilitary type thing, because like I say, it's for all federal law enforcement. I enjoyed it and I felt like I was doing a good job and I would have stayed long, probably would have just continued doing what I was doing. And being in a satellite office, what we call a resident agency, I had a lot of variety in the work I did. So there were all kinds of different cases, which, you know, I sort of illustrate in my book because, you know, there, like I say, they're a compilation of stories of those cases, and there were a lot of them. And they had a lot of variety.
Yeah, we got to see firsthand the variety. There's violent crimes, there's bank robbery, there's white collar crime, there's organized crime. They don't really refer to disorganized crime. That never tends to come up. So you can tell us more about that. Narcotics, terrorism, quite an array. You know, you talk a lot about your experiences that you lived, and I grew up living some of what you were living in the same household together. Is there a particular set of experiences or a case for you that really sort of like stands out or is striking when you think about your career in retrospect?
Well, you know, I think virtually all those cases that I depict in the book, and there were others too, all of them were memorable and pretty much in a good way. But some obviously were more memorable than others. And some of the ones that I was heavily involved in, I felt had a significant impact above just solving a crime and putting people in jail. I think they had significant impact. We had the first prosecution of an internet threat case, at least what we thought was a threat. And when I say we, I'm talking about the Department of Justice and the FBI. That case, although the indictment was dismissed by the judge, that case is in the casebooks in law school now. It set a precedent, but not only did it do that, it sort of foreshadowed a lot of the problems and things that we're dealing with today with social media and what constitutes a threat and when can law enforcement intercede when people are having conversations online that would seem to indicate that they're about ready to commit a crime. For example, a mass shooting. A lot of the mass shootings prefacing those mass shootings are communications by the shooter on social media. Some of them end up actually happening and some of them don't. And the question is when should law enforcement intervene? Or do they have to wait until it happens? And and that was the basic underlying in that particular case, which was the Jake Baker case that's in the book. We had another case where was a big undercover operation that was actually inspired by Bo Schembechler, the football coach at Michigan at the time, and had to do with us targeting the illegal distribution of anabolic steroids for as a performance enhancing drug. And there was a lot of resistance to that because I don't think people understood the seriousness of the problem. And even today, some people wonder whether we should have pursued it or not. But those are the kind of things that, and when I talk about variety, you can see that there were a lot of different things, which may have, for me, made like I say, the job was great.
We were just talking with Ben Nepton on a separate episode about his book, What Do You Want to Do Before You Die? And his role in MTV's The Buried Life. And you talked about recognizing that from a relatively young age, you wanted to go into the FBI, that you recognized that, you know, pretty early on. And so much of Ben's work is about, you know, identifying, you know, our life purpose and our passion. And we talked about how there's some research that he cited that 76% of people do not follow their most ideal life path or their sort of like authentic desires for themselves and their life purpose. How do you think you were able to follow your life purpose so expressly? And what advice would you have for others to follow their ideal or authentic life path?
Well, I think for some people, maybe it might have changed. There was a period of time when I was in high school and the first few years of college that it wasn't that I wasn't still interested in being an FBI agent, but my main focus for a while there was playing football. I also thought about playing in the NFL at that level. I was quickly disabused of that when I got to college and realized that I wasn't good enough to play in the NFL. So, but I think the individuals, I mean, I think if you talk to most kids at a young age, most boys anyway, at a young age, you know, they might want to be a cop or a fireman or something like that. And as you get older, you realize that there's a lot of different things that you can do. And so their ideas about what they want to do change. Mine didn't. And so I guess I was fortunate in the sense that this was something that I wanted to do. And, you know, it was based on having read a book and seen, you know, a movie and saw some TV shows and thought this would really be great. And as I got older, I still felt that way. I went to law school with the idea of going into the FBI. And it turned out that it was every bit as good, maybe not as the same as I thought about it as a young man, but certainly every bit as good as I had hoped it would be.
That's great. Well, you know that, of course, our show sort of centers around this idea of resilience and the framework of the five practices of particularly resilient people. Is there a practice from that framework that most resonates with you?
You know, I think it's the, hopefully I've got this right, but I think it's the productive persistence that one of the five principles. And
productive perseverance? Sorry.
Yeah,
sorry,
perseverance. I'm sorry. Yeah,
you got
and,
it.
And the, and the way I, the example that I thought of it as, it was a particular day. It was relatively early in my career, and I was working on the surveillance squad. We have in the Bureau, we have dedicated surveillance squads where when you're on that squad for a period of time, what you do is you spend your day following people. And in Detroit, at the time I was on it, our priority was organized crime, the Detroit family of the La Cosa Nostra, the mafia. And most days, that's what we did. And on a particular day in 1979, we started following some of the people, some of the leadership of the family. And as it turned out, we had two crews out that day, and the other crew, we could hear them on the radio, and they were following. And all of them were heading the same direction. And we ended up on a game farm, a place where I guess you could hunt game for a fee. And we didn't know it at the time, but it was owned by two of the main guys in the family. And this was a big conclave of the leadership of the Detroit family. I mean, everybody that was anybody in the family was there. And we'd never seen anything like that. I mean, you'd see it maybe at a funeral or a wedding in the of some of the people in the family. But other than that, and this was all just the leadership. It wasn't their wives or their children or anything like that. So when I talk about this productive perseverance, I think of it in terms of on that particular day, it's seizing the moment. And I decided that what I wanted to do, or what we should do, is find out what was going on. And we couldn't just drive into the meeting. This was private property. And I didn't ask for permission. Myself and one of the other agents on the surveillance squad, we decided we were going to go into the property. It was very wooded. And so we basically snuck onto the property and hiked about a mile or so through the woods. And we got to where this conclave was meeting. And they were in sort of an open area. We could hear them, couldn't see them very well because of all the foliage and everything. We thought, well, we can't get much closer, or they're going to see us. And I saw this open area, and it turned out it was an archery target range. It was a swath of land that had been cleared, and at one end was a target. At the other end was where all these guys were standing around. And so myself and this other agent, a guy by the name of Keith Cordes, he and I got behind this target. I had brought my camera in with a 300 millimeter lens, which is, you know, about 18 inches long. I had a 35 millimeter camera. And so I set the camera to steady it, because you're using a telescopic lens, you have to steady it. And on top of the target, about that time, Keith Cordes said to me, you think it's a good idea that we're hiding behind this target? And I think I said something like, well, I don't think these guys do archery, so I think we're okay. But anyway, I snapped a couple pictures, one of which turned out pretty well. Then we thought it was a good idea for us to get out of there. And this was pre-digital photography, 1979. So I didn't know how good the pictures were going to be, and we had to get them developed. We got out of there. We received some criticism because we basically had trespassed to get these pictures, and some people were wondering about the legality and everything. As it turned out, it was not an issue, but I got one really good photo, and it was of Jack Tocco, and he would become the head of the Detroit family for a long time. And on the either side of him were two capos, Vito Giacalone and Anthony Corrado. Capos, or Capo Gimo's captains, high-ranking people in the family. And what we found out from source information was that meeting had been called. That was the day they were celebrating the promotion of Jack Tocco to be the Don, the head of the family. And almost 20 years later, by the way, one of the pictures turned out, the one with the three of them turned out pretty well. They were recognizable. And about 20 years ago, later, there was a trial for what we call a RICO trial, Racketeer Influence Corrupt Organization. And we put the whole leadership of the Detroit family on trial. And one of the key pieces of evidence that was admitted at the trial, and there was a lot of it, I mean, this was evidence that had been gathered over that 20-year period, but that picture was introduced into evidence. And the beauty of it was Vito Giacalone, one of the people in the picture, a few weeks before the trial, had pled guilty. And in his statement to the judge, he admitted there was a Detroit family of the La Cosa Nostra. No one at that level had ever admitted that before, and admitted that he was in the leadership of the family. So when we got to trial, here's a picture of Jack Tocco, who's on trial for being head of the family, one of the other capos, Anthony Corrado, who's also on trial, and Vito Giacalone, who's just pled guilty and admitted that he was a capo in the Detroit family. So it was a great piece of evidence, and a very damning piece of evidence. And but it shows the we could have just stood outside and wondered what was going on, but we decided to go in, and we had the very good fortune of getting the picture and everything. The point being that, you know, this would have never happened had we not had the concept of a surveillance squad, and had we not at that occasion decided we've got to seize the day. We've got to take advantage of this situation and make the best of it. And it worked out.
I love productive perseverance as seizing the day and just that opportunity to make a decision in the moment to follow what feels most important. You know, you're out there crawling around behind an archery target on some private property. In that moment or in other moments, did you ever fear for your life?
Oh yeah. But it's interesting. I guess maybe a good analogy would be, it's like when you're playing football. You obviously can be injured at any point. But that's not what you think about when you're doing it. You think about doing the best in playing the game, making the block, making the tackle, whatever. So it's sort of the same thing in the Bureau. And of course, as you know, I was on the SWAT team too. And there were a lot of times when we had to go through doors and we had no idea what was on the other side of the door. Another story I tell in the book is about a manhunt we did in the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. And when we finally caught the guy who had killed four people and kidnapped his estranged wife, when we finally caught him, a couple agents were interviewing him. I was there. He was my responsibility until we turned him over to the marshals. And he looked up and looked at me and he said, "You know, I saw you yesterday." And I said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "Yeah, you had stopped and you were talking to some guys. And I was, if those guys hadn't left, had left before you did, I was going to kill you and take your car." And I knew he was telling the truth. And so he was right that what he was describing actually did happen. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I had no idea. He later told us where the rifle was that he had used. He had left it out in the woods. We found it. And in the rifle there was still one round in the chamber. And I always thought that it would have been nice to have kept that as a, we couldn't because it was evidence, but it had special meaning for me anyway. But those are the kind of things that, you know, after the fact, you think about it. I mean, earlier you were talking about how that changes your perspective on the story, and those kind of things do. You put those things in perspective when you're writing about it and think, you know, that it maybe has more significance later than it did at the time.
The bullet that, you know, didn't have your name on it, I guess, as it were.
No, and a good thing. So
right. So when you think about your legacy, did you accomplish what you set out to accomplish? Is publishing your book part of that?
I think publishing the book, it's gratifying, but again, I don't so much look at it as a legacy as just being able to describe a lot of stories that depict the great work that was done by people that I was fortunate enough to be with. It's like being on a team and having these great accomplishments that the team does, but you do it together. And so in that sense, yes. I mean, the job turned out to be everything that I hoped it would be. And I felt like I was able to accomplish a lot of things in a lot of different areas. And it was very rewarding. And you feel like you made a difference, maybe not a big difference, but a difference. And so in that respect, yes. I guess in that sense, it is a legacy. And maybe someday, you know, somebody will sit down and read it and think, you know, I wouldn't mind being an FBI agent.
I love that. Well, what else would you teach us about resilience, or how you think about resilience based on your experience?
Well, I think you set your goals. We all set goals in life, and sometimes those goals change, and sometimes you add goals. But if you have meaningful goals of the things you want to do, and You know, there's all kinds of analogies to sports and things like that. But you set those goals, and assuming that, you know, that and you don't let anybody tell you you can't do it. I mean, there may be valid reasons why you can't, but otherwise, just you go for it. And I think that resilience is part of making those things happen as best you can.
You go for it.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't as successful a football player as I wanted to be, but I took the lessons I learned from that, the work ethic and the teamwork too. And I got as far as I think I was capable, but I was able to take those lessons learned and make myself a better FBI agent because of it.
Mm. Yeah. There's wisdom in the trying. Something that I like to say is success is an answer. You know, failure is an answer, but not trying is a lifetime of not knowing.
That's true. And I think I think it's been said in a lot of different ways, but you probably learn as much, if not more, from failure as you do from success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, tell us, share with us how we can get your book, where we can find that book, and where we can find you to learn more about the work that you've done and stories that you're sharing.
You can probably learn as much about me as you want to by reading the book. The book's readily available. You know, it's the usual suspects online, like Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Target and a lot of other places. It's, you know, the title, it's published by Arcadia / the History Press. I guess I'm at the age now where my stories are history, but so I'm historical. But, I'm the author, and the title's FBI Case Files Michigan, and then the subtitle is Tales of a G-Man. I had no input in the title, but maybe a little bit, but not much. But at any rate, that's it. And like I say, it's a compilation of stories, and I'm not taking credit. I'm just the storyteller.
Dad, storyteller, G-Man, thanks so much for joining us on Flourish or Fold today. Any last words you want to share with our listeners?
I would just say that, I feel incredibly fortunate to have had the life that I've had, to have the family that I've had, and I feel like a lot of things are doable if you just persevere.
Love it. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today, and we're so looking forward to many, many people having the opportunity to read your book and to get to hear those behind the scenes stories.
Well, thanks, Karen.
Thanks, Dad.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us today on Flourish or Fold, Stories of Resilience. We hope that if you loved the stories here, you'll have an opportunity to check out my dad, Greg Stasekel's book, FBI Case Files Michigan, Tales of a G-Man. And if you liked or loved this episode, we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a review. And if you'd share Flourish or Fold Stories of Resilience with your friends, family members, neighbors, help us get the word out about this series. Thank you so much, and see you next time.